Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 108. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around it is zombies. We are going from old school 1950s zombies all the way to 2016 Korean zombies. So to start with, we're going to look at a 1957 zombie movie, Zombies of Murataw, aka The Dead That Walk. And then we move all the way to 2016 for one of the best zombie movies of the last 10 years. And that is the Korean film Train to Busan. So we're going from slow zombies to fast zombies all in one podcast. So sit back. I'm going to get the contact details out of the way and this puppy will get started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest as genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hey, how's everybody going? And the weather report as usual. The weather here is getting colder because the Earth goes around the sun in ways that don't necessarily do what I'd like it to. But, yes, I've got to live with that. The other news is that Sal and I are actually going to Sydney again. Yes, we were only there earlier this year. Nonetheless, we're going again in April. We're going up there for my birthday. It's one of those big ones with a zero in it. So we're going up there to hang out with family. And also, because it is at Easter time, we're going to the Sydney Easter Show, which is the big agricultural show. It's like the state fair for something that Americans can relate to. And, yeah, it'll be good. We'll be going up there, driving up, hanging up for a few days over the Easter break, and then coming back again. So that came up a little unexpectedly. Sally was trying to work out what to do for my birthday, so she liaised with my sister and my brother-in-law and my seven-year-old nephew, all of whom were very important in the decision-making process. And we're going. So, yeah, I do have some podcasts lined up for April. I'm doing a couple of musical podcasts, but not in the sense of about musicals, for Paleo Cinema and for Martian. I'll work something out. I may even podcast on the road. Who knows? It's a possibility, and it might be a bit of fun. I've actually got a mic that makes that a lot easier. The microphone is a Rode video mic, it's called, and it attaches to a smartphone and gives high quality audio output, which I know would be a rarity for this podcast, but it gives you high quality audio output through a smartphone. And it even has one of those furry windsock things to stick over the end of it so you don't get that when you're outdoors and podcasting. So I'm going to use that, and it's incredibly portable because you can hold it in the palm of your hand. And so I've got that, and that's what I'm going to do. I may well do Martian Drive-In while driving to Sydney, which would be kind of cool and interesting if the sound quality holds out. Interesting things happening in the world, but I'm not going to discuss them. I am going to talk about the stuff that I've been watching. There's been a few genre things I've watched. Some of them are disappointing. I did see Passengers, the science fiction movie, which has Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence in it. It's set on a colony ship, which is going to take 90 years to get to a colony planet in another solar system. And Chris Pratt plays an engineer who wakes up because of a computer glitch and finds out he's going to be by himself basically for the rest of his life, stuck on this spaceship. And so after a year of soul-seeking, he decides to wake up Jennifer Lawrence. And shit gets real. Now, this one, this, of course, is a problem at the heart of this one. And there's a problem of consent. And the movie does some hand-waving to try to justify it to a certain extent, in the sense that, you know, had he not woken her up, the spaceship would have blown up because it required two people to fix it. It's a very kind of self justifying and retrofitting the morality to fit the situation that they wanted to set up. So at the heart of it, it's a problematic film. The acting's good. The special effects are first class. The spaceship and all of the things in and around it are beautifully laid out. And so from eye candy point of view, it does work, but you still got that problem at the heart of it. People can say it's political correctness gone mad, but it's not. It's courtesy and civility and basically giving women the rights they should already have. And this movie doesn't do that. The Jennifer Lawrence plays the betrayed party very well. I mean, her acting skills are not in any doubt at all. And Chris Pratt is very good, but both of them are laden with this romantic arc. You know, boy wakes up girl, boy and girl fall in love, girl finds out that the boy fucked her over, spaceship almost blows up, and boy and girl are reunited. It's problematic. But there are ways it could have been done where it wasn't. It could have been a second glitch that woke up Jennifer Lawrence, rather than have that Sleeping Beauty creepy kind of plot arc in there. There are ways that they could have done this that wouldn't have been offensive, and they wouldn't have kind of lessened the dramatic impact of anything had it been done correctly. Well, not correctly, but in a more reasonable and less creepy manner. I saw a Sean Connery movie I haven't seen before as well, Woman of Straw, with him and Jenny Lollobrigida in it. And it also has Ralph Richardson playing his wealthy, infirmed uncle. The plot's pretty simple, really. It's something you've seen dozens of times before. Wealthy guy with a very rich uncle who he's not going to really inherit from decides that he's going to find a beautiful nurse, get the nurse to marry the uncle, and they split the money when the uncle inevitably dies. It's that kind of movie, and it's Connery just as he was becoming mega famous as James Bond. So some of the suits he wore, in fact, were suits that were made for the James Bond movies. And Jenny Lollobrigida, interesting actress from a lot of ways. She went on to become a photojournalist later in life, which makes it kind of interesting. But she's a very, very beautiful woman, but I'm not sure that her acting skills were up to the hype that the studios and Hollywood and filmmaking in general gave to her career. I think that in the long arc of things, she's more respected as a photojournalist, apparently, than she ever was as an actor. It's an interesting film just to kind of fill out the Sean Connery filmography. And he plays a total bastard, and there's a really stupid Deus Ex Machina ending in this one, which wasn't really necessary, but it's in there. Nothing you can do about it. I went back and saw a movie that was a bit of a vulgar pleasure for me. It's a movie called Hotel, starring Rod Taylor, and with a big ensemble cast. Carmen McRae's in there, one of my favourite jazz singers. Michael Rennie's in there, Merle Oberon, Richard Conte, a whole bunch of really good character actors. It's set in a hotel in New Orleans, and it's one of those kind of soap opera pot boiler things where, you know, a whole bunch of different crises occur. And it's very mid-1960s studio entertainment kind of thing. But I like Rod Taylor in it. His character is kind of interesting. And there's a suaveness to Rod Taylor that I always like in movies. I like the way he plays the character. I like the way he's, in a sense, a servant to the hotel and yet runs everything in it. And, it's beautifully shot. And it's got good music and good set design. It's got Kevin McCarthy in it as well. Just a whole bunch of really fine character actors. And every time I watch it, I kind of get invested in the characters for no apparent reason, just the fact that I like the film. So I revisited that one and quite enjoyed it. It was actually a movie that was, the DVD I have of it, and this is a slightly sad note, was given to me by the late Vince Rotolo from B-Movie Podcast. He knew I liked the movie and he found me a DVD of it because it wasn't available in Australia. And totally out of the blue, he mailed it to me. And revisiting that's kind of a reminder of Vince and the kindness of the man as well. So, it's a sad thing, but I do appreciate the movie a little bit more because of that association. I then saw a very bad comedy movie called Absolutely Anything, starring Simon Pegg, Kate Beckinsale, and the entire surviving Monty Python crew playing a bunch of aliens who decide they're going to destroy the Earth, but in order to give Earth at least the illusion of a fair go, they want to see how morally the Earth people would stand if one of them was given absolute godlike powers. And of course, the Simon Pegg character is given absolute godlike powers. I mean, this is an unacknowledged remake of a 1930s movie, a 1936 British fantasy comedy called The Man Who Could Work Miracles. It's not as good as The Man Who Could Work Miracles. There's a lot of stupid stuff in this, and it's got the usual romantic arc where a pretty ugly guy ends up with a stunningly beautiful woman because they're in a movie together. The dog in the movie is a fairly good acting dog, and the voice of the dog is played by the late Robin Williams. It's his last acting role. And yeah, it's not a good film at all. I understand why it didn't get any run. It's a movie out of its time, and it's a movie that it was actually written and directed by Terry Jones, and about a year before Terry Jones acknowledged that he was suffering a form of dementia. Now, I'm not going to go too far in that direction, except to say that I think the movie would better have been suited to be made 20, 30 years ago, in the sense that we've seen this before with Bruce Almighty and all those kind of films, and it doesn't add anything new to that. It's not particularly funny, and the jokes telegraph themselves. It's just, with all due respect to Robin Williams, a dog's breakfast. So I did see, I've been seeing some shit movies, haven't I? I did see Singing in the Rain again. I decided with the wonderful Rebecca McLaren from ABC Darwin that we would talk about Singing in the Rain. Now, there are two things about that. A, it's one of her favourite movies, so we had a lot of fun with it. And there's a lot to say about Singing in the Rain, how it changed musicals and legitimised for a lot of people dance as an art form in cinema and all that kind of stuff. The unfortunate part about it, and this is kind of sad and silly and funny all at once, is that we recorded it in the same week that Northern Queensland got hit by a cyclone. And as a result of that cyclone, about 1,000-kilometre stretch of the northeastern coast of Australia was flooded and pissing down with rain. So here we are talking about Singing in the Rain at the same time as a large chunk of the country is being pelted by rain and floods. And we acknowledge that. We really kind of went there and said, yes, and with all due respect to Queensland and Northern New South Wales, we're going to talk about Singing in the Rain. So we did that. We did it right. And it was a lot of fun. And rewatching the movie was interesting. The only caveat I have about the film, and I might be talking about this on Paleo Cinema next month, I'm not sure, is that it's kind of Hollywood patting itself on the back for inventing talking movies. And there's a kind of self-congratulations as a part of this. That's pretty much the only caveat you can have for the movie. It's brilliant apart from that. Brilliant acting, brilliant dancing, brilliant singing, and imaginatively directed by Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen as well. The best thing I've seen lately is a Netflix documentary about cinema. It's a movie, it's in three parts, and it's called Five Came Back. And it's a documentary about the five major Hollywood directors who covered World War II as a way of explaining to the American people what was happening during the war and to kind of encourage the patriotic effort against Hitler and the Axis and Japan and all the rest of them, Japan and Italy and all that kind of thing. And the five directors were George Stevens, John Huston, Frank Capra, John Ford, and William Wyler. And it's brilliant. There's a whole bunch of different people who discuss the events of World War II and the arc of these five directors going over and being frontline part of the war. They've got Guillermo del Toro, Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, Paul Greengrass and Lawrence Kasdan all talking about it. Each one of these different directors talking about one of the directors individually, Capra, Huston, Wyler, Ford, and Stevens. And it's brilliant. You're a cinephile. You're listening to this podcast. See this series. It's only going to take you 3 hours. and it's marvellous. The movie's narrated by Meryl Streep, so it doesn't turn into a total sausage party. But there are a couple of things it does incredibly brilliantly. It tells us the story. Two of the directors, William Wyler and George Stevens, were profoundly affected by the war. Stevens suffered some deafness due to being in an aeroplane without ear protection at one stage. And unfortunately, Billy Wyler was there when they liberated Dachau. And he unstintingly, with his camera crew, documented cinematically the horror and nightmare of Dachau. And it had a profound effect on him as well. One of the things this documentary does incredibly well, and it surprised me, is it gives you a deep and visceral sense of how history-changing World War II was, how people were before the war and how they were after the war, as typified by these five directors. But it gives you a real sense of the scope of the war, how it was literally a world war. It was all across the planet, and how people came together to fight the war, and how the brilliance of these five men actually seriously helped the war effort. I'm not going to do any spoilers on it. If you haven't got Netflix and you've got some internet access, pony up for a month of Netflix just to watch this. It's going to cost you, here in Australia, $12. And it's really worth it. If it comes out on disc, I'm getting a copy of it for my own reference library because I think it's that important. And you really should see it. There are a few film buff people I know, Travis Johnson and Grant Watson, who saw it the weekend I saw it, and we're all kind of agreement that it is an important documentary about cinema and about world history, and you really should check it out if you haven't already. It's called Five Came Back, and it's on Netflix. Okay, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to be talking about 1957's The Zombies of Murataw, starring Greg Palmer and Alison Hayes.
Our love story could be kind of gory, far from boring. We'd meet at a post apocalypse. I'd be slowly walking in a group stalking you. You'd be the only man alive that I could not resist. Then all of your friends, they'd try to kill us, but only because they'd be jealous that our love is deeper than Edward and Bella's. Oh, if I were a zombie, I'd never eat your brain. I just want your heart, yeah. Your heart, it just wants your heart, yeah. Oh, if I were a zombie, I'd never eat your brain. I just want your heart, yeah. I don't want your heart, it just wants your heart, 'cause I want you. You'd be hiding in a second floor apartment, knocking all the stairs down to save your life from the undead. Double barrel shotgun, taking out the slow ones. Then you'd see the passion burning in my eye, and I'd keep my head. Then all of your friends, they'd try to kill us, but only because they'd be jealous that our love is deeper than Edward and Bella's. Oh, if I were a zombie, I'd never eat your brain. I just want your heart, yeah, I don't want your heart, I just want your heart, yeah. Oh, if I were a zombie, I'd never eat your brain. I just want your heart, yeah, I don't want your heart, I just want your heart, 'cause I want you. And I try not to bite and infect you because I respect you too much. If that's why I'd wait until we got married. Oh, and our happiest days would be spent picking off all your friends, and they'd see a love this deep won't stay buried. If I were a zombie, I'd never eat your brain. I just want your heart, yeah, I don't want your heart, I just want your heart, yeah. wants your heart, it just wants your heart, 'cause I want you.
That was a nice little ditty called The Zombie Song by Stephanie Maybe. On to Zombies of Moritau. Now, I've got a bit of a history with this one because Zombies of Moritau was the first zombie movie I ever saw. I was at my grandparents' place and my uncle showed it to me on late night television. And it scared the shit out of me. I've got to kind of put this into a historical context as well. Horror movies these days, we're immune to a lot of the things that scared people in horror movies in earlier times. We've seen everything. We've seen decapitations, disembowelments. We've lived through the arc from the Evil Dead all the way through to the torture porn of Eli Roth. So, in a sense, we've built up an immunity to horror to an extent that is kind of unprecedented in movie history. People saw Gran Guñol at the theatre and things like that and almost fainted. And a movie like Zombies of Moritau was scary at the time. We've got to kind of put it into that context that people didn't see the same horror movies that we've seen. They didn't see some of the real-world horrors as well. So we'll just kind of put it in the context of this was a scary movie at the time. Even though it's hard to believe and because of where we are and who we are, we don't viscerally realise that because of a cultural difference, the familiarity with much more gory things. But the slow creeping zombies in Zombies of Moritau were scary at the time. The movie was made by Clover Productions, which was the kind of B-movie production house for Columbia Pictures in the 1950s into the 1960s as well. It did movies in all genres, just the kind of B-pictures, the ones that were on before the main feature. There's a nice little prologue to this one, which is a scroll down the screen at the start of the movie. And the interesting thing about it is that it uses two terms with which we're very familiar these days. The prologue reads, "In the darkness of an ancient world, on a shore that time has forgotten, there is a twilight zone between light and death. Here dwell those nameless creatures who are condemned to prowl the land eternally, the Walking Dead." So before Twilight Zone and before The Walking Dead, this movie name-checked them. So give them props for that. There's nothing to say that Rod Serling hadn't seen this film and adopted that phrase of the Twilight Zone for his own purposes. It'd be nice to think he did. The movie stars a whole bunch of B-movie actors, a lot of whom were more familiar with sitting in a saddle than wandering around the coast of Africa being chased by very slow zombies. Greg Palmer plays Jeff Clark, the hero of the piece, who's a diver on an expedition to grab some diamonds off a shipwreck off the coast of Africa. Alison Hayes plays Mona Harrison, the wife of the other person involved in this expedition, a guy called George Harrison, played by Joel Ashley. Alison Hayes we know from Attack of the 50-Foot Woman and any number of other wonderful cult movies at the time. The ingenue of the piece is the granddaughter of the lady who owns the house in which the group are staying, Jan Peters, played by an actress called Autumn Russell. Now, Autumn Russell was kind of interesting for a couple of reasons. If you're a film buff, you've seen Sweet Smell of Success, and there's a scene in Sweet Smell of Success where a senator is sitting down at the table with J.J. Hunsaker, played by Burt Lancaster, and a publicity guy, and with the publicity guy is a beautiful blonde who the publicity guy is just acting for a beard for the senator with this beautiful blonde. And the blonde in question is played by Autumn Russell. It's her only other major film role. In fact, it's much more major film role than in Zombies of Moritau. So, yeah, kind of interesting there. The other interesting thing about Autumn Russell is that she was married for a long time to Jock Mahoney, the guy who played Tarzan twice, and was also in the TV series Yancey Derringer. So, interesting people. She's not the most interesting actor in this movie. Now, I'll give you the plot because I haven't done that yet. This is the one from Wikipedia, but there's also going to be a bit of audio from the movie that I'm going to play, which explains it as well. Here's the Wikipedia plot. A team of deep-sea divers led by wealthy American tycoon George Harrison, played by Joel Ashley, attempt to salvage a fortune in diamonds from the wreckage of a ship that sunk 60 years earlier off the coast of Africa. When the team arrives, they discover that the ship is cursed and the diamonds are protected by the ship's undead crew, now zombies, who are forced to guard the treasure until the diamonds are destroyed or the curse is finally lifted. I think that should be, and the curse is finally lifted. As I said, there's a scientist is along with them, played by a character actor called Morris Ankrum, who was in any number of B-movies of the time, usually playing army generals and things like that, but in this case he's not. And there's the old lady who runs the house in which the crew are staying, and she's played by Marjorie Eaton, a very interesting actor. Now, I'm going to play you a bit of dialogue between Morris Ankrum and Marjorie Eaton regarding the goings-on with the zombies in Zombies of Murataw. The clip goes on for a couple of minutes, but it gives you this wonderful acting that Marjorie Eaton does. And when I get back, I'm going to explain to you why Marjorie Eaton is an important character in genre film history.
Only fools are afraid of the grave. There are worse things. Bodies around here must be buried quickly, Dr. Eckert.
You mean the climate?
No. I don't like to explain to idiots who think I'm in my dotage, but you should understand.
Walking Dead. You believe in them?
And so will you, before the week is out. My husband, Captain Jeremy Peters of the Susan B. He was one of them. That picture was made over 60 years ago. He looks almost the same today, except for the eyes. I've seen him. You know the story. The Susan B. put in here for trade in 1894. The sailors discovered a temple with a golden cask full of uncut diamonds. They stole the cask. There was a fight, and 10 of the sailors were presumed dead, the captain among them. The others returned to the ship with the cask. Then, surprisingly, the 10 missing men appeared. Something happened. The rest of the crew was slaughtered, and the ship scuttled in the bay.
You think that these 10 men that had been killed returned to their ship?
They were dead then, and they're dead now. But they're still guarding those cursed diamonds. One of them killed your sailor tonight. They killed everyone who's come for the diamonds.
But the murderers, your own husband.
They're dead, I tell you. They have no morality, no free will. They'll kill anyone who tries to steal the diamonds.
Do you see what I mean? Marjorie Eaton really commits to the role and does a marvellous job in it. She's the person with the most vitality in this film, including Alison Hayes, unfortunately. Marjorie Eaton, in her 70s, had a very crucial role in a franchise that I don't like. In her 70s, she played the Emperor in Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. She had heavy makeup made by Rick Baker and had chimpanzee eyes superimposed on her face. And the voice was provided by Clive Revel. She doesn't get a credit in the film, but she was most definitely the person who played the Emperor first in the benighted Lucas franchise. Later on, when George Lucas started finger painting over his own work, she was replaced by Ian McDiarmid. But she was the original Emperor in Star Wars. So we'll get back to Alison Hayes now. Though there's some interesting dialogue with her character and with her husband, the millionaire husband of Alison Hayes' character, and also with Greg Palmer playing the diver. I'm going to play that audio for you now because it's just that little bit sick and twisted, and you being who you are, you like that kind of thing.
You're getting drunk.
Why not? In a few days, I'm going to deck that lovely, beautiful body of yours with diamonds from head to toe.
Now, what would I do with diamonds on my toes? Never mind. It was a sweet thought. And what are you going to do with your diamonds, Jeff?
Me? I'm going to stuff mine in a nice little box I rent at the First National Bank in New York.
Oh, now that's real romantic.
You're listening to Port, Mona. Your husband's the man over there.
Can't you take a friendly little kiss without trying to make something out of it?
It's the kind of dialogue that makes us like B-movies because it's just that little bit sick and twisted and really what the fuck kind of dialogue where the husband doesn't mind his wife draping herself over another man while he's there and giving him quite a passionate kiss. Yeah, B-movies were sick and twisted in their own way if you look between the lines. But Zombies in Moritau are, yeah, the zombies themselves all look like B-movie actors, portly ones at that, who are dressed up as sailors, of course, and move slowly, and they haven't shaved for a couple of days. And they kind of, because they're silent and quite strong and hard to move, because there's a scene where someone tries to push them, and they just are kind of immovable objects. They do have a certain kind of creepiness about them, even though they're not moving fast. They're very hard to damage, and that makes them even creepier. And there's a scene in one of those old-fashioned diving suits, or in those old-fashioned diving suits, where a couple of the actors are diving on the shipwreck, and the zombies come and attack them. Now, this shows the B-movie origins of this particular movie. The diving suits have basically bubble devices in the helmets, so they blow soap bubbles upwards, and so that kind of emulates the underwater bubbles that will be there. It's all filmed on dry land, but those little bubble machines in the helmet with the bubbles floating upwards, I don't know whether they've got fans blowing them up or what, one way or the other. It's a cheesy effect, but it kind of works as well. I've got a lot of fondness for this movie. It's slow paced and it runs about 70 minutes. And it's nobody's idea of the best zombie movie ever made. Nonetheless, it does have a certain charm about it, and the B moviness of it is attractive. There's a scene, the zombies don't like fire, which is a good thing because there's a lot of fire around. And the sailors keep them away by firing flare guns at them. Now, I think the budget didn't run to having multiple flares. So what you see is you cut from the guy with the flare gun, holding the flare gun, to the zombies, and then a bright light is shone on them, and you never actually see the flare gun going off, except in one scene, because I think they only had one shot in the flare gun. And that kind of works. It's cheesy and it's cheap. And it's got that dramatic music that Columbia used in all of its genre films. And if you can find a list of Columbia's horror, science fiction, and fantasy films, there's some really interesting B films in there. They did any number of them. And unlike Universal and a bunch of those other studios, and RKO and all of those guys, Columbia really doesn't get enough love for the genre works that are put out. There is a book out which lists them and reviews them all. And there are hundreds of them. They really did pump out B product. Some of it's interesting. Grave of the Vampire, I've talked about on a previous Martian Drive-In podcast with Michael Pate playing a vampire in a Western setting. So they really, in the B movie outfit, they really did well. The movie was directed by a guy called Edward L. Kahn, who did a whole bunch of genre films, and he was quite prolific as well. He did Ip the Terror from Beyond Space, Invisible Invaders, Invasion of the Saucer Men. Let's have a look. He did a lot of westerns as well, The Four Skulls of Jonathan Drake, Curse of the Faceless Man, Voodoo Woman. Did a little bit of TV work as well, The She-Creature. So he kind of new genre works back when people weren't talking about them as genre works. He started out as an editor in Universal Studios and worked with AIP right up until his death in 1964. Mostly he did teen exploitation dramas, westerns, and science fiction movies as well. Kind of cool going over his filmography. Now, the movie was written by George H. Plimpton, who was known for writing the Flash Gordon series about 20 years before. And a guy called Bernard Gordon, who was blacklisted as, under the House Un-American Activities thing, and did a lot of his work under a pseudonym or with a front person. He did a script for the John Wayne movies Circus World, The Thin Red Line, Krakatoa, East of Java. The original 1963 Day of the Triffids he wrote. Hellcats of the Navy, which is the last movie that Ronald Reagan did with Nancy Reagan. Earth versus the Flying Saucer. So yeah, he's got a bit of cred too. None of these guys ever got to the front end of fame as far as genre works were concerned, because there were very, very few genre movies at the time that got any props at all. It was seen as a genre for children, which, it, of course, it wasn't. There were a lot of people who were grown up who liked it, including both of my uncles, Roy and John. But, yeah, I do like Zombies of Moritau. It's very much of its time. It's very much a B picture. The pacing is a little bit slow, and there's a lot of people wandering around with torches and pistols in their hands, wandering around backlots and indoor sets that are made up to vaguely look like an African jungle. But it's there's a quaintness about it and an honesty about it. They were trying to do a B-movie entertainment. They were factory workers in entertainment, in a sense, and they weren't in the posh Google-type factories. They were definitely down in the coal pits. And they made an honest little horror movie, which was kind of well regarded at the time. Later on, of course, people have made fun of it, but I've got to give it props. Now, you can see it on YouTube in its entirety. There's a couple of different versions of it there. But it was in a four-disc Sam Katzman movie collection. Sam Katzman was a producer at Columbia who produced these films, along with a few other movies, in Neanderthal Man and The Vampire, amongst others. I picked that up on that one, and it's quite a good pressing of it. There's no kind of screen artifacts. It's made from a very clean print. But if you're inclined to be a bit of a completist with zombie movies, definitely check out Zombies of Moritau.
Well, no one told me about her, way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had to. Soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there. Well, no one told me about her. What could I do? Well, no one told me about. Too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
You knew I was going to go there. That's the Zombies, but she's not there. On to Train to Busan. A very successful South Korean film. We got $78 million in the box office and about $11 million domestic in South Korea, which is gangbusters box office for a South Korean film. It was also featured in the Cannes Film Festival last year and got very good reviews. A couple of people have unfavorably compared it to World War Z, but for my money, it's a much superior film. World War Z was a problematic film at best, and any movie that ditches this entire third act and rewrites it definitely has some issues, whereas Train to Busan has a clean through line as far as its plot's concerned. Now, I'm probably going to butcher some South Korean names, so in advance, I apologize to South Korea and people like our good friend Tim Merrill, who live in South Korea. Anyway, the cast is pretty good. An actor called Gong Yoo plays Seok Woo, a financial manager obsessed with his work. He's divorced, and he lives with his mother and his young daughter, Soo-an, played by Kim Soo-an, who's about a 7 or 8-year-old young girl who wants for her birthday for her father to visit her mother in Busan for her birthday. That's the only thing she wants for her birthday. So, ditching his work for the day, the father decides to take his daughter on a train ride to Busan. They drive to the station early in the morning, and there are a few things going on. There's an office building on fire and emergency services vehicles racing to it, and there's just a kind of slight air of unease around. So they get on the bullet train, and they're going from Seoul to Busan, which is kind of heading south and then southeast, because Busan's on the southeast corner of the Korean Peninsula, whereas Seoul's up near the fairly close to the border with North Korea. I've looked this up. Just as the train's pulling out, Soo-an sees something, and this isn't a spoiler because it's in the trailer, sees someone leaping at the station master, and she's kind of confused by that. And just before the train leaves, a young lady with a leg injury staggers onto the train and collapses in the vestibule of the train. She's infected with the zombie virus. So the plot rolls out. And again, this is in the trailer. And the passengers in the train are slowly, and sometimes very quickly, infected by a zombie virus. The moment you're bitten, you're infected. It takes you a couple of minutes to die. And then instantly, you're a zombie and you're a fast, twitchy, half-blind and ravenously murderous zombie. These are most definitely fast zombies, and on the train, it makes for a very problematic situation. Of course, there are a number of other people on the train as well. There's a guy called Sang-hwa, who's a tough working-class guy, and his pregnant wife, Seon-kyung. A high school baseball team, a rich bastard. There's always got to be a rich bastard in these kind of things. And an older couple of sisters who are elderly and don't always agree. One of them is very nice and kind of accommodating and helps other people a lot. The other one's a little more cynical. So all these nice thing about this film is that there are a number of characters who have their own character arcs. They have their own personalities. They go through changes. The two sisters and their dynamic is very interesting and plays out very well toward the end of the film, as one of them has an epiphany, which has a profound effect on other people. Now, I'm not going to do a spoiler on that, except to speak about it obliquely like that. And this film, just from the word go, is fascinating and riveting. It runs for just under 2 hours, and there's not a slow minute in it. There's a scene right at the start where a man in a delivery truck goes into a quarantine zone, and the guy kind of reluctantly lets him through. And as he's driving through this quarantine zone from some kind of chemical spill, he runs over a deer. He stops to see if the car's okay. The deer's smeared across the road and then drives off. About half a minute later, the deer starts twitching and gets up again, and it's got these milky, clouded, cataracty zombie eyes. It's a very good opening scene. It really does work well to get us into the world of this film. I watched this last night with Sally, and I said, "Do you want to watch a Korean zombie movie?" And she went, "Yeah, okay." You know, there's nothing going on, so she said yes. The thing that she didn't expect, and to an extent I didn't expect her to react this way, was how profoundly moving she found it. She cried at certain parts where certain characters ended up having quite heroic deaths. And the end of it got her as well. It really did have a profound effect on her. And it's not something you normally, that's not your go-to with a zombie movie. Zombie movies are about the scare and the spectacle. They're not about the human tragedy as much as anything else. But this one definitely is. There's some beautiful dynamics between the characters. There's the incredible self-control of the young girl, Sue-Ann, until right at the end of the film. She's kind of withdraws into herself, and she's very controlled and very polite, and she's caring with other people. And there's only a moment towards the end of the film where she loses her emotional control, and that's something that we're really kind of waiting for in the film. The heart of the film is the father-daughter relationship. He's obsessed with his business. He wants well by his daughter, but he just doesn't have the time to do it. He's very business-obsessed. And there's the argument that part of that is a way of avoiding his domestic situation and the need to give his daughter the emotional support that she requires, even though his mother is doing that. And as time goes on and shit gets real in this movie, he really starts to realize, Shokwu really starts to realize what's important to him, and all of the bullshit and all of the business stuff and all of the importance of, you know, saving face and protecting the company, doing all that kind of stuff, is stripped away, and he gets to the core of what's important to him. And that's an interesting character arc, and it's played very well. The acting is terrific in this film. There's no doubt about it, and I'm rustling papers here while I'm trying to find something, so bear with me. Gong Yoo, playing Seok-woo, is really good. Kim Soo-ah, playing his daughter, is fantastic. The Sang-hwa, the working class guy, is played by Ma Dong-seok, and he is really good. I want to see an action film just with that character in it and just with that guy in it, because it really fucking works. And his wife, the wife of Sang-hwa, is played by Jung Yu-mi, and her name's Xiong-kyong. And she bullies him. She smacks him and tells him off when he disappears for a bit and isn't in the same place as her. When she meets up again, she hits him in the chest. There's a really kind of cute relationship between the two of them. Sally says there's a relationship like our one, but I don't see it. And, yeah, there are those little moments of humor in there as well with those two characters. But on the other hand, there's all of the characters are really well written and well played. And that's the interesting thing. Yeah, there are some incredible spectacles and incredible action sequences in this film. Things you haven't seen before done in that kind of way in a zombie film. And it works crazily well. But having said that, each character is carefully crafted as well. Each one comes across as a real person, and each one comes across as somebody who has their own goals and their own ambitions and their own fears. And that's what lifts this movie, that is the attention to detail and the attention to character really does make this something beyond the ordinary. There's talk of remaking this film. The Americans and Hollywood are looking at remaking it, but they shouldn't do that. I think this movie very much has a lot of culturally specific things to South Korea. There's an underlying theme of class warfare, which is kind of interesting and makes the film that much fuller. And even though Hollywood shouldn't make this film again, they shouldn't remake it, what they should do and use as their takeaway from this film is to show that action films need non-cliché characters played by good actors who have their own lives and their own agendas and who have their moments in the film to demonstrate who they are, why they're like that, and how they contribute to the arc of the plot. And this movie does that really well. There's in 1997, I think it was, there was a really bad Tommy Lee Jones movie called Volcano, where a volcano erupts in the middle of Los Angeles. It's also got Anne Heche in it. There's one scene in that movie where a guy carries a guy through a train carriage as lava's going under the train carriage and rescues him while sacrificing himself. This movie reminded me a lot of that. There's that one scene in Volcano which kind of redeems the film for me, And you know the one I mean, where somebody's walking through a train carriage with lava underneath it to rescue an unconscious person. And this movie has a lot of that kind of stuff in it. And it's blindingly good. Now, all across Asia, this was a hit. It made gangbuster money in Singapore and Malaysia and a whole bunch of other countries. In fact, the copy of this on Blu-ray that I have is the Malaysian pressing of Train to Busan. Now, I've said that there's a lot of action sequences. There are the big crowd ones where there are hordes of zombies all over the place. But there are also some really well-thought-out action sequences. Now, a good action sequence in a movie uses with the things that are naturally in an environment in the same way that, say, a Fred Astaire movie. Fred Astaire dances and uses whatever's in the environment for his dance. A good action film uses the environment and uses the things in the environment to good effect. And this movie does that as well. It uses things like train tunnels and luggage racks, the toilets in the train, the sliding doors. Everything that's a part of the environment in which the movie takes place is used by the people trying to survive in very creative and imaginative ways. And there are some nail-biting moments of tension as well. That's the other thing that America doesn't do well in action films, is build tension. Whereas this one definitely does that. There are some incredibly tense moments. There's a scene where a couple of trains crash and the protagonist wakes up. Gong Yoo's character, Xiok Wu, wakes up and finds himself in a crazy situation underneath a train. There are those kind of things in there. This one really does hit all the marks as far as a zombie film is concerned, and gives extra value because it gets you emotionally engaged with the characters and with their predicament. About a year after the film came out, there was an animated prequel to this called Soul Station, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm definitely going to track down a copy of. There's no information about there going to be any sequels to the film. I don't think it needs it. I think it's a good standalone action film. It's a good standalone zombie film. It's a good standalone character film as well. I was awed when I heard about this. I heard about it through the grapevine, of course, through social media. Grant Watson mentioned it and mentioned it was good. A few other people overseas mentioned it and mentioned that it was good. So as soon as I was able to, I did the eBay thing and picked up a copy of it, and I wasn't disappointed at all. South Korea really does punch above its weight when it comes to genre cinema in particular. Things like The Host, things like this, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, all those kind of things. All of those films, they really are doing really well, and they're giving us a view of a culture that not all of us are familiar with. It's a little harder for us to get to Korea than it is for Americans. I think it's a slightly longer flight. But I really would like to now. I want to take the train to Busan, hopefully not have the same experience as the people. It's only about a 200-kilometer, I think, train ride, so it's not an extensively large one because the South Korean part of the Korean Peninsula isn't enormously large. The other thing, too, is there's a fantastic ending. There's a two-note ending. There are two grace notes at the ending of the film, one involving Xiok Wu and one involving Su-an, which really do work very, very well. And right up until the last moments of the film, you don't know how it's going to play out. And again, that's a great thing. That's one of those things where the movie could go either way. It could turn into an utter tragedy. It could turn into a slight happy ending. And when I say that, a lot of people are dead, so it's not an unalloyed happy ending. But, I think that the choice made in this one, which is foreshadowed very early in the film, so it doesn't come out of left field. It's definitely part of the through thread of a particular character's arc. It does work very, very well. And, if you haven't seen this one, definitely see it. If you're a zombie film fan, put aside the rerun of Walking Dead episodes and watch this one, because you won't be disappointed, and it does kick ass in a lot of ways, and it does emotionally engage, which is more than can be said for a lot of films these days. So anyway, that's it this time around. I'm going to do another couple of zombie movies in the next Martian Drive-In podcast, which should be fun. I don't know which ones I'm doing just yet, but I will kind of mix it up a little bit and not do same next time around. But it's April Zombie Month, of course. Now, there's still time if you're interested to subscribe as a Patreon subscriber through patreon.com/paleocinema and get in the draw for the big draw in the middle of April around my birthday, where I give away a bunch of stuff to not only an Australian Patreon supporter, but an American one as well. I've got some special stuff for overseas ones that are quite light to transport over the ocean. And by the way, it doesn't have to be Americans. It could be UK, Europe, even Asia. So anyway, thank you for listening. Thanks for putting up with my podcasting about zombie movies. Like me up on Facebook if you'd like to. I'm more than happy to accept new friends on Facebook. You can check out the YouTube channel as well. If you type my name into YouTube, it will come up. I've got about 5 videos there now, and I'm working on a 6th one. And also, of course, you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So anyway, look after yourselves. If you're down here, stay warm. Daylight savings just ended, so make sure your clocks are right. If you're up in the Northern Hemisphere, still stay warm, because apparently it's snowing still in some parts of North America. And look after yourselves. Watch some good films. Watch some bad films. Keep watching the skies. And I'll be back next week with another podcast, another Paleo Cinema, and in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. And thanks to the two Careys who support the podcast through Patreon, of course, and everybody else who gets a credit in the style of a movie credit at the end of the podcast each and every time. And here are the credits, and I'll see you guys later. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Kerry, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.